It's March 12, 2012, and I am again at 227 Southern Avenue in Thunder Bay interviewing Will Harib. We ended off the last interview talking about some of the changes that were taking place related to ship's crews, the role of the captain, the changes in paperwork, the increased regulations and oversight. And today we're going to continue with the role of the agent. When we last left Will's career, he had just started out as a water clerk. And back in 1975, I think.
That's approximately. Correct, yes.
So let's continue on from there, where your career went, and more importantly, the kinds of duties that you took on as you moved up the corporate ladder.
Sure. Before we continue, welcome to my home. Thank you very much for coming. It's a privilege being able to talk about the grain industry. As you mentioned, the role of an agent is something that I'd like to describe. When I started in 1975, I didn't know what an agent was from bozo to clown. I really did not. As I mentioned in my last piece, I took the job as a water clerk as a summer job, but it turned out to be a long-lasting career, which I really cherish, and I'm still in the industry 37 years later. And I'm bringing my son along, David, who's 25 years old. I seem to have sparked some interest in the business, agency business in particular. The role of an agent is broad. It's what the agent does. Is the middleman between the ship owner, operator, and the shipper or charterer of the cargo, the grain cargo. Every agent starts off as a water clerk. A water clerk is a term used in the British maritime trade. They used to call them water clerks. When Captain Mann, a wonderful mentor and the fellow that was responsible for hiring me, along with Mr. Charlie Offerson, who was his operations manager. As you know, Captain Mann started Lakehead Shipping Company.
Right, you mentioned that in the previous interview.
Everybody who is an agency goes to a ship and is a clerk, or a clerk, as the British call them. And what a water clerk does, or clerk, is he attends the ship on behalf of the ship agency, and he represents, he's representing the ship owner as far as filing a clearance. The important thing, that's probably the most important thing, primary thing that a ship agent does is clear the ship in with customs. If the ship is not cleared in, business just does not occur. So you have to clear the ship in.
For people listening like me, what could prevent a ship from being cleared in?
Oh, various things. Probably one of the things is if customs feel that there is contraband on the ship, sometimes they would get tips that there was some contraband or some stowaways, and they would process the ship to inspect that there's nothing. Nothing wrong with the ship. They would examine the ship. They would inspect the ship, check every cabin, etc., etc. So that would delay things. The other thing that would delay the ship from clearance is if the ship master did not have the proper documentation. in particular, a crew list that's filled out properly on a particular International Maritime Organization crew list, or if he's not, if he didn't declare his bonded stores, the cigarettes or spirits, things like this. So when I started, customs would attend the ship all the time. They would attend the ship and make sure everything is properly presented. And as the ship agent, you would make sure that they would know this before. But sometimes the shipmaster would let his third officer do it, and sometimes he would not do his job, and it would cause some delays. And the master would be livid, of course, because he wants the ship cleared so that we could start inspection. For grain, and we could start cargo operations.
So what would happen if they found contraband?
If they found contraband, they would write up a citation, and the ship would have to pay a fine that would be levied. And in those days, you'd have to go and pay the fine, present it to the customs, and then the customs would continue their process. They would seize anything that was not declared. They would seize it. I remember one time this Turkish captain, the ship's name I believe was the Tulkan, and this was back in 1976, and the captain he forgot to declare some linen he bought in New York, some fine linen that he was going to give his wife so she could make a wedding dress for their daughter. Well, he didn't declare it, and they found it after the customs looked at all the papers. They go and check, and they found this linen. He just forgot about it. He had it under his bunk, right? And they found it, and they said, "Well, what is this? What's my daughter's material for her wedding dress?" Oh, and they were very strict in those days. I'm telling you, they confiscated it. It's a roll of white, beautiful white linen. And anyway, that was the bad part of it. The good part of it is that we convinced customs here that there was nothing nefarious about this. He wasn't trying to smuggle it or anything. He just forgot about it. It was his daughter's thing. He was so excited to buy it, and he just didn't declare it. So we managed to get it back, because they took it ashore. So we got it back. So it was a happy ending. But those type of things caused delays. When somebody's ill on a ship, it becomes ill. For some particular reason, as the ship is coming in, and if there's an injury, we stop everything dead in our tracks. As you know, mooring or docking a ship is quite hazardous, and things could go wrong. People can get injured. There was one fellow in particular on an Indian ship who was, as they were coming into Pool 15, it was Pool 15 at that time, before it was the mission. They were coming in, and the forward line broke away from the bollard. It sprung up, and the chief mate had his head down over the side, and it came up and hit him in the jaw. Hit him in the jaw, and he was injured badly, and we had phone radios in those days, so we were able to use a phone and a radio. It's one of those big long things, quite ancient in today's standards. But anyway, the captain, we were in the captain's cabin, and we were watching them tie up, because I came up on the ship really really quickly. While they were still tying up the gangway, came down, I scampered up there. I shouldn't have, but I did. I always wanted to get up there first. But the captain, as he was looking through his window, observed this. You have to call somebody really quick. This fellow's injured, because he had a report from the second mate, because he was just lying on deck. Anyway, to make a long story short, he ended up in hospital here in a trauma unit for about 7 months. Yeah, he had a very severe brain injury. But we understand he went back to sea 2 or 3 years later after that. So those are the type of things that could cause things to delay.
So to get him off?
To get him off, the crew would actually, they took him on a stretcher and they took him down the gangway, and the McKellar or the ambulance was there in about 6 minutes. I mean, we're way out at mission. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just so quick.
Did you have to do paperwork before he got off, or they
No, we just, he left customs says no problem, because they understood they were aware of the gravity of this, thank goodness. So they took him off and took him down on a stretcher, and then the ambulance guys met them on the dock, took him to the hospital.
If there's somebody who is ill to the extent, let's say that they, was there ever a situation where they were quarantined? And if that's the case?
Well, in my career, a ship was never quarantined, ever. In those days, the Department of Agriculture would check for general cleanliness in the galley, make sure that there's no cockroaches, and some ships were not very clean at all, and really it was disgusting at times. But generally, the agriculture would order the areas fumigated, and they would have a spray in there, et cetera, but to quarantine the ship for some illness, I haven't seen that. We've taken off crew to go to the hotel when we had to fumigate the entire ship, the holds of the ship, because they found insects in the holds. As you know, a ship has to present itself clean and free of insects, free of residues behind the pipe casings and the various structures in the hold. And fellows like Vic Bell would look at the holds very meticulously, and if there was some sign of infestation, they would take the sample ashore, and it would stop everything. The whole inspection process would stop, except perhaps the port warden would continue working on the stability. The customs would have had all their work done, but they would take the sample. They would take the insect, and they'd have a insect spec sheet, and if it matched it, and if it was an insect that was not indigenous to this area, they'd order fumigation with a methyl bromide fumigation, which is a lethal gas, and we would have to bring somebody in from Winnipeg or Toronto to do it, because there was no stockpile of methyl this bromide. So you'd have to take the crew off. These people would come in and put these canisters in the holds. Everybody would leave. They'd leave a crew member as a watch, but everybody would have to leave the ship. And they'd seal the hatches, and they would fumigate the ship for 24 hours while the crew was ashore. Usually the crew liked this, because they could get a little bit of R&R time in a hotel, because they were at sea for days and weeks and sometimes months. But it was a very expensive process, methyl bromide, and very dangerous. If somebody went into the hold not knowing, they die within seconds. And this would effectively kill any insect in that whole ship. And it would also fumigate the other areas of the ship, the galley and those areas. So the ship would be clean. But it would stop things for 2 or 3 days, sometimes more. So when we had to do that, the crew, it was quite complicated because you had to take the crew off and you had to tell the owners that, bear them these bad tidings because it's very expensive and they're responsible for their ship. It would cost $30,000, $40,000, maybe $50,000 to clean a ship. So it was very costly, and that was always a very sensitive thing. And being a being an agent, you'd have to make sure everything's arranged. Call these people and arrange for rooms. And some of these ships, some of these crew members had dietary situations where they couldn't eat meat, and you had to canvass everybody or ask the captain, does he eat this or what? You know, because there were some different religions on board. So it was a complicated thing.
Did they have to stay in the hotel, or did they have
We had to clear them off with customs. No, they didn't. They could go out the hotel if the captain gave them permission, but they could not leave the confines of the port. If somebody knew somebody in Duluth for some reason, he couldn't go officially. But there were some cases where guys just went and came back, you know, on the sly, they would do that. And as an agent, you say, oh, geez, what are these guys doing? Because they would totally complicate the situation further. But anyway, they would have perhaps a day or two in the hotel, and then come back and start the inspection all over again.
What about the residues of the methyl bromide, if that was the name of it?
Yeah. If the insects that were that fell, they'd be on the tank top. And it would be the responsibility of the fumigator to declare the holds gas free. They'd have these very sophisticated sensors that would determine that there's no gas, because guys like Vic and Bill Hunt and those fellows would have to go down and be risking their lives, right? They'd make sure that it was gas free. So once they determined gas free, they'd go down, look, and then the crew would sweep up these residues and hoist them up in big drums and leave them on deck.
The other situation you mentioned that they would look for, besides contraband and obviously the infestations, is stowaways. Ever a situation with stowaways? And if so, what happens to them?
We've never had a stowaway in Thunder Bay, as far as my experience is concerned. We've had deserters on many occasions, in particular in the early 80s. In the international shipping business, we had ships coming from all over the world, and literally all over the world, Russia, Poland, Korea, some Japanese ships, Romanians, British ships. If you recall, in the 80s, when Solidarity in Poland was the situation, political situation in Poland was becoming quite sensitive in terms of people leaving, and a lot of Polish seafarers didn't want to go back home because of the president, Jaruzelski, I believe his name was, the fellow with the glasses, the dark glasses. Anyway, he set up some very stringent rules. He wanted to suppress the revolution and a lot of young men would want to leave. They didn't like the political climate. So I believe in 1981 we started seeing three or four deserters, or fellows, that's what they call them officially, deserters. They would leave the ship, and a lot of the Polish nationals in Thunder Bay here would encourage them to leave, because they knew what was going on back home, and they sympathized with this whole thing. And look, these seafarers were young guys, 21, 22. Now they'd be in their late 50s, I suppose. But they took a chance, and they wanted a better life, because they knew from people they talked to that life in Poland, in particular Gdansk and those seaport towns, it was not very good. A lot of these people came from those areas. So they decided to leave, and then you'd have four or five crew that are not there. So as an agent, you have to post a bond, or the ship doesn't go anywhere. Immigration Canada, the law, it was mandatory that if somebody left a ship, the ship owner would have to post a $5,000 bond. I think it was 2,000 in those days, and they jumped it up to 5,000 per crew member.
So per jumping crew per member?
Per deserter. Or per jumper. I mean, the fellows didn't like to be called deserters. It was just the term that the maritime term for it. And I remember that year, in 1981 in particular, we had ships called the Zimia Tarnowska. We had actually there were five of them built in Argentina, five hulled ships. Zimia Zamoyska, Tarnowska, I forget the other three, but anyway, we had eight voyages from Polsteam. Polsteam were the operator. There was Polsteam in Poland, and you had Polsteam New York. So New York was North American office, and you apply for the funds from New York. You get the money, so that you'd post it. But the bond would have to be given to the immigration, as I mentioned, and then crew would have to be put back on board. You'd have to, and the company would have to send somebody to replace somebody if you had the first mate that defected or left. You needed a first mate, and you couldn't sail that ship without a first mate because of Transport Canada rules. So you'd have to wait for somebody to come in. So it sort of put a damper on things for an agent, because you'd have to scramble to get people. You'd have to pay the fine, and it's all the bureaucracy that's involved. That year we had about, I'd say, from at least 14 deserters on seven ports of call on three different ships of this same company. So what? Obviously, you know, the owners were saying, hey, what's going on? Hey, we've got a big problem here. So they internally were always very careful to have crew members that they thought that would not do this, or would not desert, because it was costing them money and time and all that other stuff. And Poland was a communist country, and they were able to put the squeeze on these guys and make sure that, perhaps they made them sign a waiver or whatever, or some kind of document saying that they're not going to do this, or else they'd be fined if they ever got back to Poland. So there was repercussions.
I have a couple of questions about the communication. First of all, you mentioned that because there's a Polish community in Thunder Bay, along with others, they were encouraging to people. How did they link up with them? How were they able to be encouraging?
Well, through the mission to seafarers, God bless them, they would go on ships, and the mission to seafarers would have a little trailer in at the Keefer Terminal. They still have it to this day. And at the mission to seafarers, they would be able to talk to people in the community, to use their own telephone or use their telephone. And we had, on a couple of occasions, some people come on the ships who were living here in Thunder Bay, and the captain welcomed them, not thinking that they would be promoting the them leaving. He was quite naive, perhaps too naive for his own good at times. But anyway, their position would be, well, yeah, you come on board, or you're allowed to come on board, but but don't talk about politics or anything. If you want to take them home to host them at a dinner or go to church, that's fine. So they connected that way, and they connected through the Mission to Seafarers communications. I'm not saying that Mission to Seafarers
subversive.
Yeah, they were not promoting this, but they understood the problem in Poland, and it was all over the news, airwaves and whatever. They weren't complicit in it. But the Polish community, they were very helpful, because they put when the ship left, of course, these guys would be in hiding, because it's an offense. You're not on the ship. You should be on the ship. Immigration is looking for you. So they're someplace, they're in hiding someplace in somebody's home. And a lot of them ended up going to Toronto and big areas, and where they got lost in the shuffle. Some were identified and caught and shipped back. But most of them stayed and became very productive citizens here. That, between 1981, I think that's when it started, 84, you probably had over 30 crew members leaving the ships between my company and Lake Superior Shipping, because they handled some Polish ships too.
Talking more about the work of the agent then. So when a ship came in, there was obviously sort of the legal stuff to do as far as getting the papers that are necessary to clear and to load and to take off again. What other kinds of things did you arrange for the ship, sort of as a matter of course?
Okay, well, there's various things. Crewmen to the doctor. If somebody's ill coming up through the seaway and it's not serious that he has to leave, he'd want to see a doctor. So you'd arrange with Dr. Doddick. He was our waterfront doctor. Dr. Cecil Doddick was recruited by Captain Rolly Mann when he came here. And Dr. Doddick was only only practicing about 6 years at the time. At that time. And he was interested in international seafarers. He had that penchant. He was very curious about these people. He was an immigrant himself, Dr. Doddick. And he took on a role as a waterfront doctor. So he would be and he would see the patients. He would put his patients aside and would see our guys. If a fellow had a rash or something, you'd call Dr. Doddick. I'd radio to the office, like we had a radio. And before we had a combination of radio and telephone, you'd have to radio. And I'd say, okay, we have three crew members to the doctor, would you please make those arrangements? So they would immediately make the arrangements, and we'd set up a taxi. Taxi would come. We always use Lacey's taxi. Remember the proprietor there, Iris, very, very pleasant, courteous woman. Actually, she's still alive today. She's about 91. But that's one of the things. Then provisions. Ships need to require food to put on a table for them to eat fresh vegetables, meat. Some of these ships would come direct from overseas, and that would take maybe 12, 14 days, well, 9 days across, and another 5 days here, 14 days. And they would try to replenish some of the fresh provisions. So we would call a ship channeler. That's what a ship channeler did.
And who were the ship channelers in town?
You had Frank's Locker Service in those days. We dealt with them. And actually, they're still in existence today, too. But a lot of the ships now, they recognize that everybody's penny pinching. The captains want to save every penny, and they would instruct the cook to go to the superstore or a big Safeways or whatever, and they would buy their groceries themselves because the ship channel would mark things up quite high. But still, you would need a ship channeler for other things too, for perhaps some technical things. They would have to make up some nuts and whatever they would need to do to fix something. You know, they'd have to get some of these things machined, and a ship channeler would take and do it. What else would we do? We would make sure the captain is very, at times when we had in those days we had a pretty good budget, so we would take the captain out for lunch or dinner. And a favorite place was the steakhouse on Memorial Avenue, which today is the infamous Other Place. Which will remain nameless if you'd like. But anyway, that place was a very important maritime meeting ground for lunch. A lot of the people in the maritime industry would go there for lunch. And Uncle Frank's, too.
What was the name of the steakhouse?
It was called the... It was called the Steakhouse. Does that ring a bell? Byron Hill. Byron Hill Steakhouse. It was pretty fancy in those days. It was one of the fancy places. And I remember Captain Mann, he didn't skimp on treating these masters very well. And when he wasn't able to do that, or when Charlie Onferson wasn't able to do that, I would do that. Later on in my career, in the 80s, as I got more mature in the business. But that was always fun to do, because the shipmaster would spread the word, and he'd say, well, yeah, that agent was great. And that would be a good marketing tool for us.
So you talked about the different things that needed to be taken care of, just for day-to-day functioning, like the food, medical, I assume there was dental.
Dental.
And what about cleaning?
Yes, dress well. Good thing you brought that up, Nancy. You dress well, cleaners would do the laundry. And that was always really tricky to watch, because they'd have these huge, big, white sacks, probably around a meter in diameter, and another meter high, two or three of them, and they used to lower them down on their crane, and Dressball would come with a cart and put them on the cart and take them to the Dressball cleaners on Syndicate. So that was a pretty good business for Dresswell, and of course that would all go on the ship disbursement, on the owner's account side. So in the shipping agency, you'd have to make sure whose account is what, because what you do as an agent, you pay the bills for the ship while it's in port, for every bill. Sometimes the captain had cash. If he preferred to pay cash, a lot of them didn't, because it came out of his budget, and he'd have to account for that. A lot of them said, no, I want to sign for it. And then when I started in the business, I remember they always told me, make sure you don't order anything until you tell us, because we have to get the owner's permission, because we don't want to get caught without, you know, having it paid. But that was one of the things we did. We had to call the authorities on a fellow who died on the ship. He was a guy in his mid-50s, and he had a heart attack, and he died. I think this was at P&H Elevator. We had to get the coroner there. He succumbed to a heart attack, and then, of course, there was a lot of bureaucracy there with customs, immigration, the police. You had to get the local undertaker here, and I think we had Jenkins handle the affairs. The sad thing about it, the family didn't have money to repatriate his remains. He was buried here.
Do you know where?
He was buried at the, my goodness, the cemetery. Mountain View. He's buried in Mountain View. And the ship owner did not want to pay the money to get him back for the family.
Do you know what?
Very poor. They're a poor Indian family.
Do you know approximately what year that was?
I would say that would be, Nancy, 1983, 84. I'd have to look at my records. It's off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. But it was quite an experience. 14 years later in the 90s, one of the relatives of the guy called and wanted to know where he was buried, and they believed they had enough resources to bring him back, to exhume him and bring him back. So we connected him with the authorities here and with the Jenkins people and with the Mission to Seafarers. At that time it was Dave Bradford. I wish you would have had a chance to interview Dave Bradford. He was Missions to Seafarers fellow for a long time, along with Reverend Thompson, Alvin Thompson. But the outcome of that was it was too costly, as it turned out, to do that. And when he visited the gravesite, he thought it was a very fine place, and that's where he is today.
There is a headstone there?
I believe there is a headstone there, yep.
Hmm.
Yep.
So sad.
Yeah, it was a sad thing. But anyway, those are the type of things you deal with as an agent. There's a lot of different things that come up that don't expect. I remember one time we had this one fellow, and he was a real ladies' guy, according to a lot of people on the ship, but he went missing. And we had to find him, right? And one of the guys says, no, I think he's at one of the houses here. So as a water clerk, I had to find out where Lacey's taxi took him. I had to do a little bit of an investigation through whatever sources I had, and we found that he was on Pearl Street. So I didn't want to go inside to knock on the door and say, hey, we've got a crew member that has to come out. We have a ship sailing. I think what happened was we had one of the taxi drivers go in and say, hey, because he was there for, I don't know, hours. It's the cost of a mint. But anyway, we had Lacey's taxi go in there and fire and say, hey, the captain wants to see you. So he finally made it back to the ship. So that was one of the more little funny tidbits of this business.
How much of an effort did you take to find people? Were you responsible for actually tracking down this fellow? Probably easier to find than the ones who were trying not to be found.
Well, in those days, we had enough staff where I was able to be as a water clerk. I was in my 20s, my mid 20s, 27, 28. When I started in the business when I was 26, but between 20. Before I was 30, my main stuff was running to the ship and maybe finding a crew member someplace who got didn't recognize the time. And Charlie Umferson would say, "Hey, go down the mall and see if he's there." And you'd have to go and try to find this guy. You put him in your car. And I liked that because I got car allowance in those days. Everywhere I went, I logged my car allowance, so I didn't mind searching around. And in those times, too, as a water clerk, Captain Mann paid $5 a visit per ship, not counting my salary at the time. And this was when I was learning the business, and I found that the more times I went to a ship, the more money I made. So I would make a lot of trips to the ship. Not only because I liked the life and I liked what it was, but it was making me some money. But I learned quite a bit, a lot of stuff doing that.
People that did not want to be found, did you have to put up any effort, or
no.
You knew it was futile?
Because you'd have an indication if somebody jumped the ship, like these Polish guys. I wouldn't be looking around the Polish community or phoning people up and say, "Hey, you've got our Polish third officer. We want him back." Forget it. That's up to the police now. That's a police matter. Didn't want to get involved in that, and we weren't supposed to. So,
about the police. We paused a bit for a telephone call, and at the time you were saying it was a matter for the police when somebody jumped ship. So if you could just briefly say how the police operated, especially how it, did they have to interview you?
Well, let me clarify that. It would be an immigration matter. The immigration matter would extend to the police and the federal police because obviously he's here illegally, and Canada Customs have their rules and regulations, and they are legal ramifications. So if the fellow if that particular fellow, they do a search on him and they find he's got some kind of a background, then it becomes really a police matter. But by and large, the immigration, Canada Immigration, would be the policing entity.
Okay. It sounds like you've had a number of stories during your career that help keep your interest in the industry alive. Let's just step back a bit and look more at who was your company agents for, and how does somebody build up an agency?
Lakehead Shipping Company, as you know, was developed by Captain Rolly Mann, and he had a catalog of ship owners that he knew from his dealings with people in Hamilton when he started when he came ashore, and he was such a gregarious guy, and he would travel and he would develop contacts. He would travel the world and in those days you had to visit ship owners in Hamburg, in England, Norway, Sweden, New York City in particular, and you'd have to cultivate your clients. You'd have to do that, and that's the way he garnered the reputation for Lakehead Shipping, because of his travel and him knowing that the personal contacts were so important.
Now, when you talked about the different places that he visited, and my understanding, very limited, of the shipping industry, is that there's been a real changeover in where ships are registered, who owns them, and so on. Did that have any impact on Lakehead?
Well, there were ships registered in countries of convenience, like Liberia, Marshall Islands, but that didn't say that the operation was there. The operations were in their head offices in Greece. We were the agents for Olympic Shipping, which was Onassis's, Mr. Onassis, everybody knows him. We were agents for them, and Captain Mann knew their contacts in New York. And Captain Mann, every spring, would visit, in particular, New York. He'd make a beeline to New York, and he'd see because that was the hub in the late 70s, early 80s, and before that, before I started, the 60s, New York City, right downtown Manhattan, you had all these shipping companies. And of course, he would make trips to Europe and talk to a lot of these people in order to advertise Lakehead Shipping.
Is New York still the center?
New York is a very important shipping hub. Today, for an agent in Thunder Bay, it's really Montreal. And the charterers' offices, like the shippers, like JR, JRI, you would go to Winnipeg. Because sometimes charterers have the privilege of choosing who they want as the agent. So important to get both sides. There's sometimes where ship owners have the prerogative of choosing an agent. And in their charter party or the contract, the charter party is a contract. That's the term we use in the maritime industry. It's the contract between the shipper and the owner, charterer, or the ship operator. So in the contract, they'd say charterer's agent, which means the owner has no choice. The shipper would choose the agent.
So who were some of the major charterers that you would be dealing with?
JRI would be a major one when I started off. We had ConAgra Grain, Continental Grain, A.C. Topfer, Dreyfus. Of course, Dreyfus now, a lot of those offices, the shippers' offices were in Winnipeg. So it'd be one-stop shopping. If you wanted to do a solicitation trip, as it was called, first what I used to do when I took over the company in 1989, I would visit the owners first. I'd go to New York, visit Polsteam, New York, Polish Ocean Lines, various other ship owners, and I do 2 days in New York, visit those people, then I shift to Montreal to see all the ship owner operators there, in particular guys like people like FedNav. FedNav is the largest Canadian international ship owner here, and they've got a worldwide reputation. They've grown so large and so big. And they're family-owned by the Pathy family. And Captain Man, I remember him going to see Mr. Pathy. And I remember seeing correspondence way from the 60s that he would visit Montreal to see all the ship owner representatives there. Ship owner reps like Colley Motor Ships, Robert Reeford Inc., Robert Reeford, the oldest shipping company in Canada from 1868, I believe. But those are the things that you would do. You'd see the ship owners and you'd say, well, we're alive. You're waving, what you're really doing, Nancy, is waving the flag. You're making sure that you're there and you want the privilege of representing them. So you would do that. You would take, it's one big entertaining thing. It's one lunch after the other, or after hours thing. You'd be in one bar or you'd be somewhere having dinner and then do the whole thing the next day.
So why don't you weigh 400 pounds?
My boss, my predecessor almost did. He was a big guy, but God bless him. Charlie Umfreson was a very, very big guy. He loved life, and he liked to eat well, he liked to drink, and he liked to smoke, and he liked all those things that you really shouldn't be doing. And he was paid for it in the end, unfortunately. But he was my mentor too, Charlie Umfreson. Getting back to solicitation, you would do that. You would go to the ship owners and make sure that they're aware of what you're doing, because there was a competitor here. My competitor was Lake Superior Shipping, Mr. Sandy Henderson, who's still here with his son. So he's still my competitor. But anyway, after that, you would go to Winnipeg. Winnipeg, of course, you would see all the grain companies. You'd go to the Canadian Wheat Board, you would go to various Excan Grain, United Grain Growers in those days, which morphed into Viterra, which is morphing again at this day into another sale of this British outfit. It's not official, but a British company, one of the biggest grain trading companies in the world, is reputed to have put a bid in for Viterra, and it has to go through government approval, like they had with this potash controversy a couple of years ago. But I think it's going to go through. So you would wave the flag to the charterers, because the charterers would have the choice of picking an agent, and if you did your selling job well, and if you convince them that you are the right guy for the job to represent them, then you're in their books. And sometimes they would try to play fair, where they would say, okay, well, we'll use you on one ship, we'll use the other fellow, your competitor, for another ship. That happened sometimes. But we usually had our clients, and we respected the wishes of the charterers, and we never called down each other as agents, because that's just not the way to do things. You respect who your competitor is in every regard.
So what changes have you seen over time then, from when you first started and your mentors were doing the contacting, and now?
Well, you see a lot of change. A lot of companies have spread all over the country. A lot of the charterers have gone from Winnipeg. Viterra is in Saskatchewan, Regina. Dreyfus, Louis Dreyfus, is in Calgary. They've got a big office there. There's some office shippers in Vancouver now, so you've got to be all over the place, and it's a bit of a chore traveling like that. It's you're up and down on an aircraft all over the place, but you have to do that every 2 or 3 years. You don't want to do it every year, but you could if you've got the resources, if you wanted to, wanted to do it. But mainly, you would go to the clients that you knew, that you know that you had to perk up a bit, that you wanted to try to have them. We knew they were using the other agent, but we always went in and said, "We're here for you. If something ever happened over here, we're here. We respect your client. We think he's a darn good agent. Great. However, we're here for you." So those are the things you're doing.
What I've in interviewing people in various parts of the trade, personal relationships were always a major issue in getting a contract, not getting a contract.
Very important. Very important to the personal contact. You become friends with these people. You know, first they're contacts, then they become acquaintances, and then over the years they're friends. You could count on these guys for giving you business, mm-hmm. and confiding in you, giving you some inside tracks to some important information you require. They're very helpful, and they provide you the livelihood with how to succeed in your business. And so a lot of these guys I've known 30 years, 35 mm-hmm. years, and they're still in the business. Yep.
So, how important is price?
That's become very crucial lately, because the bottom line is the dollar. And as an agent, the poor agent is always getting pecked away at his fee. Everything else is going up. Tug bills are going up, fuel is going up, and the agency fee, although the Shipping Federation of Canada puts out a guideline on what agents should charge. It's only a guideline. For example, the guideline for a ship loading over 20,000 tons, the agency fee would be about $5,800. But in the last few years, you see that ship, even though they like you and they think you're a real great agent, It's money that counts too, and this word rebate, it gives me a shudder down my spine. But you hear that, I've been hearing rebate for all my career. Usually it could be a 10% rebate. It's all legal. I mean, you're just mm-hmm. giving a rebate it's like when you go shopping, they give you a rebate. Okay, it's fine. You keep on going there, right? So to stay in the game, they request a rebate. That's a request. It's not a demand. Of course, if you say sorry, well, they're not going to be they'll be your friend, but they'll say, hey, we're going to have to use the other agent because he's offering something a little bit more attractive. This is an industry of dimes and nickels now. Really, it is. So we try to make that money back by charging for use of a cell phone or communications, and you know, those things add up. You give the rebate, and then there's things that you can develop legitimately. A car allowance per day, gas is going up. It's gas today, $1.31. Agent typically would charge $150 a day just for the use of the car while the ship is in port. So those things add up. You give. And rebates are anywhere between 20% and 50%. So, yeah, it's a really money oriented type of business today.
Before we move on to the elevators,
yes.
Are there other stories that you can think of? Gee, that's a good story. I didn't want to forget to tell that. Mm-hmm. Or anything else that you want to say about the business? Or
well, one story that I think. Should be told I told it to you several weeks ago. It could have been an international incident. It almost was. This goes back to the early 1980s, and I'll be brief. It was a Bulgarian ship that had to go into the Kiefer terminal to clean for grain. She was going to be loading flax, I believe. And she came into the Kiefer terminal, and one of my responsibilities was to call the customs, of course, to clear it in. And in those days, they would come on board. So they would, in this particular case, we had two new customs officers, two guys that were relatively new, because I didn't recognize them. So one of them asked to see the captain's safe. The captain thought, well, yeah, just take a look. One of the guys, customs officer, said, no, we want to take a look inside. Captain says, no, I can't do it. I cannot do it. And he looked at me, he says, Mr. Agent, I cannot do that. So, and he motioned to me, and he said, you know, this is very sensitive. We can't do this. I said, why? He said, I can't tell you now. We just can't do it. And meanwhile, the customs officers are wondering, what's going on? They're getting more curious and curious, right? So the customs says, no, you'll have to open it up. And the captain says, no, I refuse. So I immediately talked to my boss at the time, Charlie Humphreys. And I says, hey, Charlie, we've got a problem here. The captain doesn't want to allow the customs to look into his safe. So it's a little safe, like about 2 feet by one, like an old-fashioned thing.
The dial.
Anyway, so Charlie said, well, you better get the captain to call his owners right away. And in those days, he didn't have a phone, but he could call from the bridge through VBA radio. It was very costly. And they used to charge the call in gold francs, believe it or not. Gold francs. From Thunder Bay, you're calling, and the captain said, I'd like to have my charges. And they said, well, that would be 185 gold francs. Where they got that from, God only knows. Anyway, he talked to the owners. Owner says, nope, don't open up the face safe. We're going to call the embassy. We will get a representative from Ottawa to meet you tomorrow. We can't do anything. Meanwhile, the captain said, okay. We went back down to the cabin where the customs guys were. They were looking around here and there. So we said, no, sorry, gentlemen, we can't. We have direction from the owner that we cannot open the safe. Oh, okay. So they got onto their superiors. Their superiors got onto the RCMP. The RCMP got onto the OPP. We had been at dock about 5 hours, and this is becoming a real, real international problem. And RCMP showed up, OPP, and I'm there as the agent. Good thing I was dressed well. But I remember in my career, you have to be courteous, and if you're mad at anything, you don't show it, especially to the authorities. You don't do that at all, because you make matters worse. So we explained to them that there will be somebody coming tomorrow to open up the safe. He's not allowed to. They said, why? We're not allowed to tell you. Okay. They said, okay, when is this guy coming? And by that time, we knew he'll be coming about 10:30 in the morning. I had to pick the fellow up. It was a Bulgarian representative. I think the ambassador's assistant. And a name a mile long. And I picked him up. And I said, well, we're going to meet at the ship as we planned. At 11 o'clock in the morning, we have to meet there, and you have to direct the captain in what the authorities want. He says, okay, don't no, no very thick accent, big Bulgarian guy, you know, big bear of a guy. So we took him down, and everybody was there, OPP or RCMP. They had a police guard on the ship overnight. It just totally, it was like a movie. So the guy came, and the diplomat came. He says, "Okay, Captain." He talked to him in Bulgarian, and I could understand it because Bulgarian is very close to Russian and Ukrainian, and I spoke those languages. I speak Ukrainian. And actually, one of the reasons I got hired, too, because I could speak more than one language. But anyway, he said, "Okay." Captain said, "Okay." And then in his broken English, the captain said, "Well, in 1 minute, it's all orchestrated." He says, "Captain, customs, okay, I'd like to have the customs here, and I'll have the police are here. I will open up the safe." So, right in 1 minute, it was like on cue, like it was a theater arts thing, you know. Okay, minute said, "Okay." Captain went, and he dialed he opened up the safe. He had a couple of clicks right, two clicks left, another couple of clicks right, and he opened it. It went click, clink. And everybody was looking like this, looking down at the safe inside, and there was a manila envelope, and we observed it. The customs did not touch it. RCMP did not touch it. They were, I think, ordered not to touch it, like overnight. Don't touch it. We just want to see what's inside. So they looked, and it was a thick envelope with a wax seal on it, old-fashioned wax seal. It looked like something from the 1700s, right? They said, "Okay, you can close it." And that was it. It was just amazing. After all this stuff, all this bureaucracy, guy flying in from Ottawa, from the Bulgarian embassy, obviously they had some direction not to make a big federal case out of it, because it would have been it would have been all over the news and God only knows what. So they just said, "Thank you very much. Thank you, Captain." And they all left at once. And I said, "Captain, what did you have in the safe?" He said, "We have orders in case of war that we get from the capital in Bulgaria. They would tell us to open up the envelope, and in the envelope is directions what we have to do in case of some kind of conflict." And at that time, it was very, you know, the Soviet Union, which controlled Bulgaria, all that, those communist countries, was very sensitive. And you had the Cold War. And the captain says, "No, if I opened up the fridge, I'd be in jail." So that was an interesting story. I remember that was quite
your intrigue. Intrigue.
Very fascinating story.
Well, we're over our time. I could go on forever, but okay. I'm eating into your lunch hour. No. But you did, and I really want to talk to you about elevators.
Right. Now, as you know, when I started, or if you don't know, I'll describe it. When I started, we had 17 elevators in the port, 17 working elevators. The first elevator I ever went to was Cargill, which was Grand Trunk. People call it Grand Trunk Elevator, and they still do today. But I remember that was the first visit I made to an elevator as a shipping agent. Although I had worked in an elevator in 1973 for 3 days, my brother Mike, who started at Sask Wheatpool 4, right out of university in 1971, in those days, they were making a lot of money. And he coaxed me to join up in the car shed. And he got me a job at Pool 4. So I knew what an elevator was. But the car shed was, I just didn't like the, it was just terrible working conditions as far as I thought. And my brother thought I was too soft, right? I lasted 3 days and I quit. And I went to work someplace else.
It was it hopper cars by then?
No, they were grain dirt cars. And you'd have to go in there and take all that grain, the residue out of there. And I didn't like that.
So they didn't have a dumper either, a grain car dumper?
They did. Well, let me think. Well, in any event, I just didn't like the atmosphere, so I did leave that career. But anyway, getting back to the elevators, when I joined, you had all these elevators. A lot of these ships that we had would shift to three or four elevators, which was quite costly. And in those days, it was very lucrative for a tug operator to be around because he'd be shifting these ships from one elevator to another elevator. At that time when I started, then you had operating at Searle, you had Pool 15, which has become the Mission Terminal. It was idle for several years, and they brought that back to life. Then on the river, on the Cam River, you had, I remember there was Patterson that was operating, and which didn't, I think they tore it down, or they stopped using it in 78, 79. But anyway, you had also on the river.
Before you go beyond Patterson, were the two elevators at the Turning Basin still there, but were they operating?
They were, Western 10 and Western 11, they called them. And to this day, Western 10 is operating as Western Green.
Well, I'm thinking the other direction.
No, they were not. There was that elevator was not operating.
The last picture I saw, one was called the Purvis, and I don't know what the other Purvis for service.
Actually, it's in this booklet okay. that you could you'll look at. But no, though the in 1975 when I started, those were the elevators. These are the elevators that were working. I'll just list
okay.
them. Western 10, Western 11. You have Pool 5. Saskatchewan Pool 5, Saskatchewan Pool 8, and then across at Intercity, you had P&H, you had Manitoba Pool 1, and then across the slip, you had McCabe's. Those two elevators shared the same slip. One would be starboard side 2, the other one would be port side 2. So you couldn't, you'd have, if a ship was at Pool 1, you'd have to get the ship to shift up to, okay.
So we're ready to go?
Yeah. So.
We ended with McCabe. You were just talking about when a ship came in to Manto, to McCabe's, you had to.
Yeah, well, you had to be careful because the slip is very narrow, and you've got two ships that are perhaps 70 feet in beam, and one ship would have to move up the dock mm-hmm. to allow the other one in.
So, did you have to be as an agent? Did you have to be on the dock when they were loading?
No, no. What an agent does as the ship. Comes in to the dock, you attend the ship. You attend the ship. What you do, when it's all passed, et cetera, you attend the ship every morning to discuss what the loading situation is. And it's a courtesy call, basically. That's what you would do. Then sometimes you would come back at the end of the day. So you would visit the ship regularly. But anyway, sometimes it was difficult for ships to be loading at the same time at that area in that slip. Then, of course, we have Pool 7A.
Was Thunder Bay Elevator gone by then?
In 1975, Thunder Bay Elevator was a dormant elevator. Just no use on that. It's still standing today. Then, of course, you had 7B, Saskatchewan 7B, and Canada Malt at that time, which is still shipping malting barley out. You had Manitoba Pool 3. It was a good elevator, I remember. They mothballed that.
What makes something a good elevator?
Well, because it was a good... you had a good load rate. I think you had 1,400 tons an hour, three loading spouts, I believe. A very efficient...
Which elevator was notoriously slow and fast?
Well, depending on the commodity you were loading, you'd have a different load rate. By and large, all of them were good, very good. One thing really astounded me was the when you asked for figures for elevators up the river, like Western 10, you'd get them in you know, a minute. They'd be very, very quick. Up to you wanted 4 decimal points or 3. So they were very, very mindful of what information you needed. And some of the bigger places, they would say, no, I'll call me in a half an hour or whatever and get that. But by and large, they all operated efficiently in terms of trying to get the grain out of the elevator because they were storing it. The quicker you get it, you had it delivered to the ship, the quicker you could get more cargo grain into the elevator. So timely loading would be very, very crucial. Just to give you another, the other elevators that were in existence at that time were Richardson's. Then you had Pool 4, Saskatchewan Pool 4. And on the other side, you had Alberta Pool 9. So those were, they shared the same elevator slip, if I recollect correctly. Elevator Pool, Alberta 9, I think stopped shipping grain in 76, the year after I was there, or late 75, I'm not quite sure. And then, of course, you had UGGA, which was a great elevator to load at. You had 6 loading spouts, a lot of water, great to get in right from the north entrance, straight in there, port side too. No shifting at the dock. A lot of these elevators you'd have to shift at the dock because they had maybe 2 loading spouts and you'd have to shift at the dock to facilitate the loading in the holds.
Did you have to do anything as far as the logistics of slip depth and so on, or was somebody else doing that?
The depth was always it was the knowledge of the port. When I started in the business, we'd have a description of the elevator, what the depth was, and of course, the depth would be recorded on a chart, on an official chart. But you have to be mindful too. These charts sometimes aren't accurate, and if there's any question of water depth, the ship almost always takes soundings to make sure they have enough clearance under the keel, under the hull. So they would take soundings, and it would give them the safety, knowing that there's enough water, because if they touch bottom, then that's a problem. Who knows, they could damage the ship. The ship has to be afloat at all times.
So did you ever have to do some sort of quick footwork to when things weren't accurate and you were expecting to get a load of a certain amount at a certain elevator and then all of a sudden, whoops?
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, over the course of a season or a few seasons, Lakers, when Lakers load, they touch the bottom. They could move a lot of stuff around. It could create a berm or something, and when saltwater ships come in, they could be loading at a particular position, and they could hit this berm, and the quirk is that it would, they wouldn't be going down, being submerging, it'd be a problem, and they would say, "Oh, we don't have enough water. We can't do this. We have to." And there's a big protest. The ship files a protest to the charterer, and he makes a big case out of this thing, because and he's not been here before. Usually, captains this happens with captains that haven't that are not familiar with the port. Captains who are familiar with the port, ship owners, they would say, "Okay, well we would come off the dock a bit, get off this berm a bit," and they would certainly try to facilitate the loading with the elevator. But no, there's been cases where captains just refuse to load a certain amount of cargo.
So what are your choices there? As
the agent, you would try to convince the captain that it's all a bunch of malarkey. By and large, it depends on who you're working for. If you're working for the charter, you say, "Well, captain, no, you got to load this. You got to load this ship."
We're okay.
Are we?
I was asking you what your options are. You had mentioned that one is to persuade the captain that all hell is not breaking loose and something
right,
could happen.
Right.
But
we would probably say, and invariably the ship has been loading there successfully, and we'd point that out. We'd say, "Well, this ship loaded no problem. Why don't you slacken the lines off? Just come off the dock a bit. The grain trimmers will get the pipes in the hold, and you shouldn't have a problem. You've got a lot of water in there." Because we would ask them to give us a sounding depth illustration. Basically, you would draw a diagram of the ship, and at different points of the ship, he would define how much water there is. So we would say, "Well, no, you've got enough water here, so just get off a bit and you'll be fine." Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't work. If you're the ship owner representative, and if he says, "No, I'm not loading," then you go to bat for him. But, you know, it's been sensitive late in the last 5 or 6 years because of the low water level issues in the lakes, especially in Lake Superior, and ship owners have to be very cognizant of what could happen if they do touch the bottom, and if there's damage. So they have to be mindful of that, and they have to be mindful in particular of the bottleneck we've got in the St. Mary's River, because we've got to pass through the St. Mary's River. You could have 10 meters of water in Thunder Bay, but if you only have 7.9 meters in the St. Mary's River, what good is that? So ship owner, the ship master has to be aware of what prevailing water levels are at Sault Ste. Marie in particular, because those fluctuations could go 2 feet either way.
So climate change then has implications?
Climate change has a lot of implications in our business. As you know, the port in 2006 dredged to 8.5 meters, dredged various elevators to 8.5 meters at the elevator's expense, plus they had some subsidy money. They didn't do anything up the river, much to the chagrin of Western 10 and Mr. Mayotte. He's got a point to argue. I mean, he's a bona fide elevator. And the unfortunate thing is they're not going to dredge the Cam River. It's going to cost a lot of money. But anyway, water levels do play a very important plays a very important role.
More excitement for you. So you've started your own company.
I've started my own company. I operate Thunder Bay Shipping, Inc. My son, David, is on board with me. And actually, we're just planning for a trip to Montreal next week to introduce David and to wave my flag. And we'll be ready to compete with the other two fine agents we have in the Port of Thunder Bay.
Okay, well, this has been wonderful. Great addition to our what we're referring to as the big jigsaw puzzle of the grain industry and all of these pieces that have to come together in order for it to work. So thank you very much.
I'm very glad to be a part of it. Thank you, Nancy.